There were years, not so long ago, when my job as a Russia watcher meant spending several hours a day reading and writing about the Kremlin's diabolical schemes to undermine Western democracy through troll farms, botnets, fake news networks, and, I don't know, stolen data leaks. Pundits and policymakers were in the bylines and the headlines every morning with terrifying new revelations and allegations about Moscow's long, spindly arm. To be sure, there's plenty of evidence cataloging the cyber attacks of Russian hacker groups like Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear, not Fozzie Bear. I'm often tempted to say Fozzie Bear's in there. He's not. He's something different. And there's evidence of how these advanced, persistent threats work with Russian intelligence agencies. Western concerns about Russia have shifted in the last couple of years, of course, as the focus has moved to Ukraine and outright military threats involving tanks, warplanes, and occasionally even nuclear weapons. But folks, it's an election year in the United States, and like it or not, we're set to get the same matchup as last time. And the lead-up to voting this November is sure to renew fears in the United States about Russian malign influence. And that means more paranoia from politicians, more alarming op-eds and white papers from the institutes created and funded to draw attention to foreign disinformation, and more mutual suspicions among ordinary people on social media, where journalists and pundits often draw their anecdotal conclusions about popular opinion. This week, for a skeptical view of the foreign disinformation threat, I spoke to Gavin Wild, an adjunct faculty member at the Alperovitch Institute, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and a former director of Russia, Baltic, and Caucasus Affairs at the U.S. National Security Council. Welcome to The Naked Pravda. Howdy, folks. Welcome back to the show. I'm your host, Kevin Rothrock, the managing editor of Medusa in English. On this week's show, I spoke to Gavin Wild, focusing on two articles he's written in the past few months. There's a March 26 paper in the Texas National Security Review and a May 3rd essay in Foreign Affairs, which he co-authored with Olga Belegolova, Lee Foster, and Thomas Reed. The titles give away the core arguments here, so let me read them both. First, there's From Panic to Policy, The Limits of Foreign Propaganda and the Foundations of an Effective Response. And then the co-authored essay is titled, Don't Hype the Disinformation Threat. Downplaying the risk helps foreign propagandists, but so does exaggerating it. As Gavin and his co-authors point out in their piece, the specter of Russian propaganda is alive and well in American politics. Representative Michael McCaul, the Texas Republican who chairs the House Foreign Affairs Committee, recently told Julia Yoffe at Puck News that Russian propaganda has infected a good chunk of the Republican Party. Earlier this year, California Democrat and former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told CNN that pro-Palestinian protesters in the U.S. are repeating Mr. Putin's message, and she even claimed that some of the activists are connected to Russia. Now, for millions of Americans, and obviously for some of the most important politicians in Washington, these comments are damning revelations of malign foreign influence, not baseless paranoia or attempts to scapegoat American policymakers. Considered alongside the ample evidence that adversaries in Moscow and Beijing do covertly seek to influence American politics, many reject the idea that Russian or Chinese disinformation even could be overhyped. Our very democracy is at stake, damn it. This is existential. And this is where I began my conversation with Gavin Wild. How do you square warnings that, you know, disinformation is, the threat of foreign disinformation is overhyped with the fact that, you know, there's no doubt that Chinese and especially Russian intelligence services are seeking to use technology and propaganda to sway the American public covertly? Like, if somebody's whole job is, say, to track that kind of thing, and you come to them and you say, you know, this disinformation threat is overhyped, how do you get on, like, the same footing with these people? Like, it seems as though you're disagreeing on too many sort of a priori levels that you can't even converse with them. But I assume that's not true. So what is the conversation you have with people from that perspective?
Yeah, no, I think it is a very difficult circle to square, and it's certainly not meant to besmirch any of what I think is good faith attempts to, you know, whether it's protect democracy or to call out Russian perfidy, like all good things kind of on their face. I think the proper way to really approach Russia's idea of information warfare in particular, but probably the idea of propaganda more broadly, is like a Ponzi scheme. Yes, it involves trickery and fakes and deception to some degree. Yes, it's going to probably dupe some subsection of the public. I would argue most likely those who are already prone to making poor investment decisions beforehand. But also, yes, I think it would be silly for, say, the Wall Street Journal or the United States Treasury and the Securities and Exchange Commission and the FBI to kind of swarm towards Ponzi schemes and treat them as if they comprise the entire economy or as if they pose some kind of existential threat to it. And I think kind of managing the distinction, again, if we use this Ponzi scheme as an example, manage the distinction between criticizing a Ponzi scheme and criticizing the product that's being sold. So, for instance, it would be silly for all of us to expend a great deal of resources and focus on debunking the health claims of a vitamin supplement that's being sold in a Ponzi scheme, or worse, to try to decide to go into business as a kind of competing Ponzi scheme selling a higher quality vitamin supplement. You'd kind of be missing the forest for the trees if you focus so much on the product that you fail to educate people on the fact that Ponzi schemes are bad because it's a fundamentally unsound economic model. And I think the correct approach would be to point out how Ponzi schemes are good at one thing and one thing only, and that's really channeling clout and resources to the very people who cook them up. And so the value in studying information warfare thinking or disinfo and propaganda and researching how they conducted it, I think, is more in debunking the myth of its efficacy, not in reinforcing it. And that's a fine distinction, but I think that's one the West, and certainly here in DC, we kind of need to climb our way out of the latter and get better at the former. Because at the end of the day, if you look at your research and you go, does this present Russian propaganda and disinformation as if it's as powerful as its theorists wish it was? Or does this educate folks on how cartoonish and what an unfortunate view of the world and the way information works?
Is it fair to call it like the anti-disinformation? Is it a business or is it a policy group or preference? Like, what do you, I mean, maybe it exists in different formats, but where do you think it's most, I don't know if pernicious is too strong a word, but like, where do you see the overhyping at its worst? Is it with like the people working with disinformation in sort of in a business capacity, whether they're like getting grants or running foundations or something like this? Or is it on the policy side? It's like the FBI and the White House and you know, the actual government. Like, where is the problem worse in your opinion?
I think it's in the best case scenario, I think we've inadvertently built a bit of an incentive structure on all those scores where we've now created a feedback loop. Like if you put a bunch of amplifiers in a room and face them at each other, it's now just kind of this self-sustaining din where bad actors in Russia decide to do a thing in motivated by the fact that if they do a thing splashy enough and loud enough and get some coverage in the US media or by the platforms or by civil society, they can take printouts of that, go to somebody in Moscow with power, political patronage to offer and say, look, we're doing a thing, and allow them to keep doing it. And the same incentive structures exist here, whether you're in government, whether you're in media, whether you're in civil society. We caught them, we see them doing this, we're getting better at understanding how they do it, we're exposing them, and that kind of, all of that din around the actual tradecraft and the attempts really drowns out the deeper question of, well, did it actually mean anything? Are we just all incentivized now to keep attempting it and keep exposing it for its own sake? Now, that's in the best case scenario. In the worst case scenario, what I think there's probably an ideology of counter-propaganda or anti-Russian disinformation that's taking shape that starts to adopt some of the same qualities as certainly folks in Moscow and I imagine Beijing have, where they've started to view the information ecosystem as if it's all orchestrated, as if it's all mechanistic. They start to view any narrative whatsoever as being necessarily kind of controlled by outside actors, all of which kind of excuses their own failings at governance, all of which would excuse their domestic political elites from their own role in fostering a healthy discourse. So that conspiratorialism and that hubris, I think, starts to kind of be a weird mirror image of the propagandists themselves. And I think, you know, referencing Hannah Arendt in the 1950s, I think she's probably the best thinker we've had on kind of totalitarianism and propaganda in the last century. She talked about how propaganda is an escape from responsibility. It's a sense of community, a prepackaged sense of identity, and ultimately a sense of control over a chaotic socio-political environment. Well, in a weird way, I would argue that the way we think about counter-propaganda, however noble our motivations may be, sometimes leads us down those same pathways where it becomes a bit of propaganda in and of itself.
How elastic is the sort of foreign adversary quality here? I know that you've worked a lot on Russia, the Baltics, the Caucasus, and that sort of region of the world. And so a lot of your research on disinformation is grounded there. But you've mentioned Beijing, and China comes up a bit in some of these articles that I've been citing. And I know that this very much follows whoever the geopolitical bad guy is in American political thinking. But let's say, you know, this maybe the 50 years from now, we're really going to be at odds with India or Brazil or something. Do you see the arrangements of counter disinformation right now? They could just sort of slide into that too. Like, that's how this stuff is built.
I get the sense that played a big role. I mean, especially in studying how this kind of took shape over the last century. Certainly, it was just kind of a bit of the flavor du jour. You know, McCarthyism was a big illustration of that. Whichever geopolitical adversary is kind of most looming largest we start to look at them through that prism. I think that informed a lot of our discussions on TikTok in DC over the last year, frankly. But that's what I mean when I say, like, adopting the information warfare mindset, whether that's the regime security flavor that Moscow adopted long ago, or kind of the righteous democracy protection flavor that the US and a lot of Western thinkers have adopted more recently. I've come around to the idea that mindset is just inherently autocratic at its core. I don't know that it can fundamentally kind of coexist with the cornerstone that underlie a democratic system, free expression and association, and, you know, high degrees of tolerance for dissenting viewpoints, and a certain degree of trust that's required in the notion of organically occurring public sentiment, however, you know, empirically sound or counter to its own interest, as it were. So, because the fundamental instincts of this kind of information warfare mindset are insecurity, are conspiratorialism, are hubris. And when those tend to be institutionalized by the state, they usually take the form of censorship and technocracy and repression. And I think you're starting to see some of those inklings take shape in the discussion around propaganda in the United States presently. And a lot of that is what augured the op-ed that Thomas Ridd and Olga Belikova and Lee Foster and I wrote recently.
I had a question about, this actually goes back to the Texas National Security Review article. You have this interesting enumeration where you say that states generally perceive information as a threat in three general categories. And you say that there's technological, the ability to defend networks, that one makes sense to me. Intelligence, the ability to avoid surprise, okay. And then the last one, you say cognitive, the ability to protect the public's sense of well-being. And you note that in 2016, Moscow breached all three, but this cognitive category, maybe the most jarringly, those are your words. And I wondered if you could kind of explain a little bit more about what you mean when you say the public's sense of well-being and how that relates to Russian disinformation operations during that election.
Yeah, I mean, I refer to this idea of kind of ontological security, by which I mean kind of this ephemeral sense of continuity and stability that publics want to feel and that governments like to sense that they are the guarantors of security over. And so this kind of notion in 2016, certainly coming on the heels of, you know, culturally, the United States, we have end of the Cold War, the end of history, a lot of exuberance, democracy won, communism failed. So culturally, we kind of have this sense of continuity. And the 21st century, post 9/11, global financial crisis, et cetera, like, there's a lot of disorientation happening. So we were already a little bit on our toes, if you will. And I cite a great book by Martin Gurry called The Revolt of the Public in this paper, but he kind of described that sense of disorientation. It was already just kind of a byproduct of the times we were living in that weren't the result of any kind of calculated push. But then 2016 happens, and there is the sense that a foreign actor has in a very big way that's not very familiar to the U.S. body politic rattled our cage in a way that we had not been used to before or hadn't really experienced in that same way. And so I do think there was a legitimate sense of, certainly in 2016 in the circles that I was working in at the time, like there was a legitimately felt sense of this is something qualitatively new and different that we need to figure out how to deal with.
In the sense that Russia's intentions were shocking, or that there was impact that was shocking?
Or probably that there was an event that happened that we did that was shocking in and of itself, like the hack and leak operation and this idea that we already had domestically, irrespective of Russia, kind of an odd, shocking event that was unexpected in Donald Trump's election. But then the very notion that there might have been an external actor that had their thumbs on the scale that might have in some way, you know, tipped it one way or the other, that was just that's a shocking notion, especially for people in national security circles who feel like that, you know, that's my job to protect the United States from that kind of thing. And so paired with the fact that Russia has this very, and, you know, this is what kind of had me worried at times. That sense of unpreparedness paired with the fact that Russia has this very self-reinforcing, holistic way of thinking about information warfare, that posed a real dilemma and seemed at the time like a recipe for more disaster, certainly around elections and the democratic process, et cetera.
So this, I'm having a little bit of trouble reconciling. Maybe you're just talking like in that moment, that was the feeling, but what I'm hearing is like, okay, you know, the foreign adversary potentially had their thumbs on the scale. This American security establishment is shocked and worried. And the Russian security elite have a particularly aggressive and self-sustaining or somehow, like they're not going to lose sight of their mission at any point because they're committed and they have an ideology that drives them. This sounds to me like what you're describing is like indeed a real threat and all hands on deck, man the harpoons, like this is trouble. But that's not the argument you make in the other two articles. So what happens between 2016 and now that we can reassess?
Well, so I think a couple of things. And again, this paper is a bit of my own deconversion story from that period of panic, which again, I kind of acknowledge is rational and is born of good intent. But I think now the pendulum's probably swung too far of past acknowledging Russia's approach to the information environment. And now almost I worry that we've in some circles decided to adopt that same kind of viewpoint of the information environment ourselves. And I think the more research you dive into both history and the humanities, and certainly in cognitive science and political science, social psychology, and for complexity science even, the more you kind of see how extremely limited we are in understanding how individuals and groups form attitudes and beliefs and behaviors. And often researchers in these fields can't replicate the findings of their studies at all, much less across time or geography. So there's very few ironclad universal forms or laws governing human media interaction or deception. Everything is very contingent, everything's emergent and unquantifiable. So there's very few places where we can draw causal chains from some input to a predictable output. Now, you contrast that vast universe of uncertainty with this notion that because Yevgeny Messner, Igor Panarin, Chekhinov and Bogdanov, or Valery Gerasimov, wrote some articles or made some PowerPoints demonstrating that societies are as malleable as a canister of Play-Doh, that they've somehow cracked the code of social engineering. There's a lot of hubris on their part and some willful credulity on ours if we accept that at those two ideas at face value. So these guys, I think, were selling an idea internally to the power brokers of their day in Moscow. They didn't stumble on some holy grail of persuasion and subversion that, frankly, you know, the American advertising industry has been searching for over a century. And so finding a place where, again, we can acknowledge that they are guided by this magical thinking, but this magical thinking does not necessarily represent reality. And making that distinction, and I think too few national security thinkers are incentivized to make that distinction, or certainly in the commercial and civil society space, I think we need to do better at making it.
I was very interested to read the arguments you had about the use of hard science and analyzing media interactions. A lot of it echoed, because I studied in two aborted PhD programs. One was in history, one was in political science. And especially the political science one, where it was really a lot of like, okay, is this a hard science? Is this a social science? Like, is this science at all? And basically when reading your article, a lot of what came to mind was this obsession with data analytics and the faith that they will actually reveal reality and predictable science and so on. That seemed to me to be extremely American political scientific thinking. And I wonder, you know, what you just said is, you know, there are these Russian policymakers who seem to have sold Putin and the Kremlin decision makers on this idea that they have the magical tools to brainwash Americans or something like that. But their American counterparts could then turn around and be like, well, hold on, we have to fight this with our own counter brainwashing tools. To me, seems so quintessentially American. It's funny because both sides are really living up to sort of the stereotypes that we have about each other. But here we are.
Yeah. And I think I make this point in the paper, but I think every time a lot of those folks in the humanities get us closer to saying, there's no real magic bullet, there's no hypodermic needle, et cetera, it's more complicated than that, some new technology comes along. And certainly since the advent of, you know, so-called surveillance technologies, that kind of promises advertisers mostly that with enough of these data points, we can reduce humans down to these finite bits and pieces and model them so that they're predictable. And so that hopefully they will see something and click something and buy something. And I think we've tended to kind of adopt that Stafford Beer kind of management technocratic mindset and project it onto our adversaries, certainly in the case of whether it's, you know, the Internet Research Agency or Cambridge Analytica or now TikTok. But also we've decided, well, this is probably something we need to get in the game on too. And I think on both scores, there's a little bit of certainly snake oil being sold by people with a profit motive, but also by people with a political motive. And that kind of leads us to the unfortunate tenor and tone of the conversation in DC around Russian propaganda being the root of, you know, all evils, especially when it comes to discussions around Ukraine assistance, et cetera. That I think it's unfortunate and is kind of, we need to reset the clock a little bit in these combos.
And so resetting the clock, letting the pendulum swing back to something more reasonable or moderate, where then would you stop the pendulum from going the other way? Because obviously some of your advice is to ignore a lot of the disinformation because it only, you know, gives it new life and so on. Where would you say, okay, well, you don't do nothing there. Like you, or rather like, you know, the police infrastructure in place, the intelligence community and so on, like they still need to do that. What are some of the that's?
So I look at outfits certainly like the Global Engagement Center, where there is a noble mission to document and discuss where we have pretty good forensic concrete proof of some kind of orchestrated, intentional, goal-oriented plot to do a thing. I think there's a documentary history piece of this that's certainly legitimate, and I'm glad people are doing it. Where I think we, the broader we need to be careful is in how we cover it, whether it's from a journalistic perspective, certainly a civil society one. We just need to choose our language more carefully and ask ourselves before we hit the publish button or before we go testify on the Hill or make a statement from the Hill, are we reinforcing the Kremlin's power, purported power, this mythology? Are we reinforcing it by what we're about to publish or say or do? Or are we educating folks on a broader meta? Are we making a broader meta commentary about the practice of propaganda? Or are we feeding into the mythology about it? I think that's the question everybody across the board needs to ask as they approach one of these, because as Thomas and Olga and Lee and I wrote, like so what was the impact? What was the real world impact? And if you either don't know, go back to the drawing board and see if you can figure that out. But I think among my co-authors, I'm probably the most skeptical. I I think the empirical search for these causal kind of relationships is probably destined for rabbit holes and is probably an unanswerable question at present.
I wanted to ask you about the partisan context of concern or paranoia about foreign disinformation, because it seems even in the foreign affairs article, we get some of the examples we get are Nancy Pelosi saying that some pro-Palestinian protesters are connected to Russia. You mentioned Marjorie Taylor Greene parroting what appears to be Russian disinformation, but it turns out it's good old homegrown stuff about Ukraine's corruption. We have Texas Republican Michael McCaul saying that his party's base is, you know, infected with Russian propaganda. So it seems to me like a lot of the allegations of being under the influence of foreign influence or Russian influence are directed at Republicans, and they often come from Democrats, but as we see, sometimes they come from moderate Republicans. But this seems to me to be important partisan context, and this is also why I assume, again, I'm kind of speaking, you know, intuitively, I'm not a U.S. politics expert or anything like that, but it seems like a lot of Americans are just sort of following partisan cues. Like, how important is the partisan context to disinformation, specifically Russian, but maybe if you could expand also to Chinese disinformation and foreign influence operations, something like that. Like, how important is it to understand the partisan context here?
Like you, I'm certainly no expert on the kind of political science and the partisan dynamics. I think a couple of things I would note just intuitively, rather, as you say. Number one, I mean, I think nothing in these articles should be construed as in any way, any kind of endorsement of the kind of bullying and partisan hackery, frankly, that's happening against researchers in the United States using the bully pulpit of certainly Congress. I think it's unfortunate. It's besides the point, I think, in a lot of ways, and it's a bit of demagoguery and distraction. But what I think is maybe perhaps a meta commentary that I would like to make that I think we sense was probably a risk even back as far as 2016 and some of the discussions I was having, at least, it's very difficult to have conversations about communication and who has the power to say what. When you enter that fray, whether that's as a researcher or a national security official, or from any position where you would putatively like to come at it from an apolitical position or one of neutrality and objectivity, however much you may hope for that to remain an apolitical conversation, when it gets to issues of power and elections in particular, it's not possible to play referee without becoming a quarterback. You don't have control over that anymore. And so I think the community that thinks about these things need to be very clear-eyed about, we will perforce have to become players on this field if we wade into those kinds of discussions. And that's going to come with an unfortunate, it sounds like, side effects. But I think the flip side of that is part of this disinformation discussion seems to absolve our domestic political elites from their own responsibility. It's just too simple a scapegoat to say, you know, Nancy Pelosi or Mike McCaul are saying X, Y, or Z because of Russian propaganda. That construction means they personally are not held to account for expressing their own opinions and communicating why they hold a certain viewpoint, and for us to be able to kind of hold them to that. There's a sense of zero-sum game, particularly when it comes to issues around Ukraine, of if you can't hold a position that, yes, in a very indirect or inadvertent way, Putin or the Kremlin or Moscow could conceivably capitalize on, ergo, it must be a byproduct of Russian propaganda, I think is harmful and is not something anyone from any political persuasion should wade into, because there is a very important debate that the American public owes itself to have about America's interests vis-a-vis Russia, America's interests vis-a-vis European security and Ukraine. And I'm not going to try to arbitrate, you know, what those are with any finality, but I will say I think for a lot of folks, certainly in DC, to dismiss some of that debate or paint people that have legitimate questions or want to have that debate as fellow travelers or useful idiots or Russian stooges, I think is extremely counterproductive.
Thanks for tuning in, folks. This has been The Naked Pravda, a podcast from Medusa in English. Remember that undesirable status back in Russia means our entire news outlet now relies on readers and listeners around the world to support our work. Please visit our website for information about how to become a contributor with one-time or recurring pledges. Thanks again. Until next week.